Salo Falava, I'm Afamasanga Seyuli Salamasina Von Reiki, and I'm inviting you to join me on a journey through the evolution of our Pacific cultures on Culture Compass. We'll meet incredible people dedicated to preserving traditions while adapting them for today's world. Join me as we travel the Pacific to celebrate our resilience, revival, and deep-rooted connection.
Search for Culture Compass wherever you get your podcasts to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
Gasalele hafa a day, ali and good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Coming up, investigations into Timor-Leste over alleged scam centres. There's a continuous debate over whether banning Gava is necessary after a massive haul worth hundreds of thousands was seized in the Northern Territory of Australia. We speak about whether Fiji's newest political party will mean anything for everyday Fijians, and has Papua New Guinea's rugby union been abandoned by Oceania Rugby? Stay tuned for all those stories and more, but as always, we want to acknowledge that our show comes to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. I'm your host, Aggie Tupou, and I say thank you to Mas. Thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. Firstly, investigations are continuing in Timor-Leste after police raided several alleged scam centres in and around the capital, Dili. More than 90 foreign nationals have been brought before the Dili District Court, where judges are considering bail and travel restrictions while the criminal investigation continues. The United Nations has warned that Timor-Leste could become a new hotspot for scam centres as Asian organised crime groups target countries with weaker regulations. Our Timor-Leste reporter Vanya Vieira has been at court following the proceedings, and she joins me now. That I say, bon dia, Vanya. Thank you for joining us.
Bon dia, Iggy. Thank you.
Vanya, do you mind taking us through the key details of this case? Like, how did the raids unfold, and what are authorities alleging?
Yeah, well, Iggy, it was highly coordinated intelligence-led operation, like National Police of Timor-Leste officer, and especially the Scientific Police for Criminal Investigation. So simultaneously, on several high-walled private residence, apartment, and rent hotels across Dili. These locations were specifically chosen for their privacy and their use of Starlink satellite internet to maintain high-speed connection. Inside, police uncovered sophisticated call center-style setup, like managed by hundreds of foreign nationals from China, Indonesia, and Cambodia. Authorities are alleging a massive transnational criminal network. Like, they have saved thousands of SIM card and SIM boxes used to mask international calls, claiming these hubs were running big butchering investment scams and illegal online gambling. But there is a much bigger picture here. Like, experts call this the Mekong Sieve, as law enforcement cracks down on scam compounds in Cambodia and Myanmar. These syndicates are seeking new frontiers. They are targeting Timor-Leste because of its use U.S. dollars and relatively weak cybercrime laws and poor visa system. Yeah, Iggy.
Yeah, that sounds like a very sophisticated setup there. And with those who have either been caught, what's actually happened to them, or what's happened in court over the last several days?
A judicial hearing was held over the weekend and last Monday, yesterday, at the Dili District Court for total 125 nationals arrested in major cybercrime crackdown, lead prosecutor by Dominguez Govea and Ivan Suryati has formally charged that the group with three crimes as a criminal association, money laundering, and illegal online gambling. The court has imposed a term of in identity and residence, periodic reporting requirements, and a travel ban. Alongside a bail between 3,800 to 4,500 Australian dollars for each defendant. But on the other side, defense lawyers have different perspectives during the interrogation. They claim that many of these individuals didn't come to Timor-Leste to work in scam call center, but rather for holidays or to seek legitimated employment. Mm. The lawyer argue that the police allegation of online scamming must be backed by concrete facts and proper investigation, and they urging authority to maintain professional standards. Yeah.
Wow, Vanya, thank you for that. We understand also that the United Nations actually warned Timor-Leste, you know, they could become a new hotspot for scam centres. So are these raids part of a wider problem, or what other suspected operations do you think the authorities have uncovered?
Yeah, absolutely, Egi. What we are seeing in Dili is a classic case of what the UN calls the displacement of organised crime. As law enforcement cracks down on scam compound in the Mekong region, especially Cambodia and Myanmar, these syndicates are migrating south, seeking out regulatory soft spots like Timor-Leste. The raids have pulled back the curtain on sophisticated transnational infrastructure. We are not just talking about laptops and phones, but authorities have uncovered Starlink satellite terminal used to bypass local control and avoid taxes. The investigation has also moved beyond simple fraud. Like, authorities are now uncovering a wider criminal ecosystem, including illegal online gambling and cryptocurrency laundering.
Vanya, what's been the response then on the ground in Dili at the moment?
Public anxiety is mounting in Timor-Leste as online scams go viral across the country. Reports indicate that several local citizens have already fallen victim to these fraudulent scams. A significant concern is the low level of cyber literacy, which is leaves many people vulnerable to sophisticated online fraud. And in civil society, part groups are urging the government to take security more seriously and strengthening oversight. They are calling for the urgent introduction of a cybercrime law to combat the rise in digital crime and prevent the number of victims from growing further.
Mm-hmm. And look, as this type of situation continues to increase, what now then, Vanya, happens next in the court proceedings, even maybe in the broader police investigation?
The immediate focus is on the judge's ruling, which will determine whether there's more than 100 suspects remain the pre-trial detention or are realized on that contest bail, which is mean $3,800 to $4,500 Australian dollars. Looking more broadly, to rework is only just beginning for the PNTL, like Police National Timor Forensics Teams. They are now tasked with creating a massive trial of digital evidence to trace where the money went, and crucially, to identify the masterminds behind this operation who remain at large. And once the investigation is complete, the findings will be handed back to the public prosecutor to proceed with further legal action and future court hearings. Yeah, Iggy.
Thank you, Vanya. Well, I know that you will be keeping us all informed as to the outcome of this proceeding. But again, we just want to say obrigada. Thank you very much for coming on the show this morning.
Nada manahigi.
Thank you. That is our reporter, Vanya Vieira, speaking to me there from Timor-Leste.
Discover the stories that shape our region on Culture Compass. Travel across the Pacific with Afmasanga Sayuli Salamasina von Reiki as she traces the shift from oral traditions to online connections, explores the delicate balance between conservation and cultural practice, and follows the ukulele's journey across the islands. Culture Compass, a journey through resilience, revival and deep connection. Tuesdays at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Good fellow morning. Welcome back to Pacific Beat. Now, coastal communities in Papua New Guinea's Manus province say their lives have continued to be disrupted by vast rafts of floating pumice from an ongoing underwater volcanic eruption. The pumice is spreading across the province's waters, drifting west towards the capital, Lorengau, and east towards Lombrum, where Australia is helping to build a naval base. Locals say reefs have been smothered and fish stocks decimated, leaving families struggling to fish for food or earn an income. Manus villager Rex Pora says communities are increasingly worried about what the eruption could mean for their future.
The pumice are coming from the underground, undersea eruption at Titan Ridge in the Bismarck Sea, about 125 kilometers east of east coast of Manus. It struck first on the southern islands, Baluan and Low, and then the south coast villages, including Pere and Timonai. It has now reached the Los Negros LLG where I live. Loniu Village, Naringel are all affected, and the rafts are now moving along the Loniu Passage towards Lombrum Naval Base. From there, it is spreading in two directions. It is going west towards Loringau to Rara Island, and also it is going east to Papitalai Village and Lombrum Naval Base, where the main ships are. And it has pushed across the other end of Naringel, Momoti Airport, Riuriu, Mokoreng, and Chapon. So it is no longer a South Coast problem. It is wrapping around the whole province. It is now at the doorstep of our main town, Loringau, our airport, Momote, and the naval base, Lombrum, that Australia is co-developed.
Is the pumice moving or is it surfacing? Is it showing any improvement at all?
It is doing both. And no, there is no improvement. Fresh pumice is surfacing because Titan Ridge remains volcanically active, and the rafts are constantly moving with tides and currents. What is worse, some of the buildups have already solidified along our shorelines, hardening into banks of rocks 2 to 5 meters thick, while new materials keep arriving on top. We are dealing with three things at once: an active eruption still feeding the sea, rafts on the move, and solidified pumice already locking up our beaches, passages. Some scientists tell us that these materials can accumulate and circulate for months or even years. We are preparing for a long haul, not a short emergency.
What are the villagers concerned about?
First and foremost, they are concerned about food. Our people fish daily for their meals and their income, and the reefs are being smothered. Fish, corals, seagrass are dying under the rock. What we can't sell fish, when we can't sell fish, you have no money for anything else. Transport is a second worry. Boats can still move in places, but only very slowly. Pushing through the rough, so a trip that costs 20 minutes are now taking hours, and reaching the shores itself is a struggle. And thirdly, tourism. Manus is known for its white sandy beaches. They are now buried under grey volcanic rock. For communities building a future around visitors, that feature is now covered with grey volcanic rock.
How many islands have been affected, and have they received any help from the funds that the government had announced?
Every island off the south coast is affected. Baluan, Low, Rambucho, and the rest. And beyond that, every village in Manus that relies on the sea, which is virtually all of us. The Prime Minister visited and announced $5 million in immediate relief. We acknowledge that. But on the ground, our LNG president says they have not seen anything yet. None of that $5 million has reached them. So no support from the government has actually reached our people. Communities are still waiting to feel it. The distance between announcement in Loringau and food supply reaching other families in the islands, that's where the people are heading right now.
What is your concern?
My concern is simple. We're not getting the support we need. And what has been promised is not coming quickly enough. Our people don't need more assessments. We need practical solutions now. We need containment nets to stop the rafts entering our passages and wharves. We need dredges and barges to gather the pumice and clear our beaches, our landing rafts, the Loni Passage before Loringau and Momoti are cut off completely. This is where our friends can help. Australia is our biggest neighbor and a partner at Lombrum, minutes from this affected village. Clearing equipment, logistics for food and clean water, and scientific report to test the discharge and monitor our reefs. These are practical things that can be delivered quickly. For Manus, the sea is not scenery. It is our road, our garden, and our bank. When the sea is blocked, everything stops. We need help now, not later.
And that there is villager Rex Pora speaking there to ABC's reporter in PNG, Belinda Cora, about the experience of communities dealing with pumice from the underwater volcano at Titan Ridge. Turning to Australia now, where more than 2,000 bags of cover worth more than $100,000 have been seized by Northern Territory Police in the remote First Nations community of Rimanining in Arnhem Land. Cover is illegal in the Northern Territory, and supplying or selling cover carries severe penalties of up to 8 years in prison. Locals say cover is a popular drink in a number of First Nation communities in Arnhem Land, and there has been debate over whether banning the drink is necessary. But concerns over substance abuse has many supporting the law, while others say it's a safer alternative to alcohol. One person advocating for its legalisation is Dione Lothu, the son of Fijian missionaries who was raised in Arnhem Land.
The ban came in during the intervention in 2007. They had to come up with some reason of, you know, kava, alcohol, drugs. So they just chucked kava in with it, not fully understanding what kava was. I mean, it's one of our traditional drinks in Fiji and the Pacific, but we wouldn't. I mean, just the other day, Fiji signed a treaty with Australia about a defense treaty, and the Prime Minister of Australia was drinking kava there. So the question, you know, the question comes back to, Why did they ban it? They didn't understand it, so they thought they'd ban it. See, all Methodist missions in Northeast and Northwest Arnhem Land, there's about 8 communities. They're the only ones that consume kava. And now kava was brought in because it was a choice by, you know, the First Nations people, because it was something to counter the ravages of alcoholism and drugs, especially in the mining towns like Nhulunbuy. In there, I would like to see it legalized, because not for my benefit. I drink kava because, you know, my background is Fijian, you know, with the Pacific Islander. I'd like to see it legalized because the black marketeers that sell it today, they charge exorbitant prices, and yet they can't police it, because every time I go out into a community, they're drinking kava. I think it's time that we brought it. We brought it up now.
How did it become popular in Arnhem Land, kava?
Okay, I'll give you a very brief background. There was this Fijian, like community worker. He was an ex-missionary. He's still alive. He lived in Nhulunbuy or Yirrkala. He took a group to Fiji just to see how things happened there, and they saw how people sat around, shared a bowl of kava during a village meeting and things like that. So they wanted that. This was in 1982. So they brought that out, and since then it's grown. But it's kind of gone through the roof since they banned it. Like anything, I don't know why, you know, people haven't kind of realized, hang on, the only way to counter this is to legalize it. And, you know, the demand will kind of fall. I mean, it'll just go according to the supply and demand. But it's nothing special, kava itself. Like anything, if you abuse it, you know, it impacts on your health or things, but you don't get drunk in the way that people kind of say alcohol makes you a bit stupid when you drink too much. Kava, in fact, just puts you to sleep.
Substance abuse, yeah, in First Nations communities, how big of a problem is that? And I suppose that was perhaps one of the reasonings behind banning kava, right?
I'll put it to you this way. You can walk into a supermarket in Brisbane and buy kava. Yet, if you try to bring kava into Arnhem Land, you get fined, or you even get put into jail. And that's just because it's done to the First Nations people. Anyone else, like us Pacific Islanders, we can bring in about a maximum of 2 kilos. Because before 2007, we were selling kava here, but you had to be, you know, a registered provider. The only people that benefit are the black marketeers. The people that suffer are the First Nations people. And they're suffering now because of, you know, money that they get in there for their pensions and whatever is used on kava.
Have there been any consultations, whether at a community level or a state level, about kava?
Earlier on, there was some. But and I'm talking to around 2010, 2011. Recently, I think people have just accepted it.
And that was Dione Lothu, the son of Fijian missionaries, who was born and raised in Arnhem Land. He was speaking to Pacific Beat's Whenau Whanua there.
Pacific Beat.
All right, welcome back to Pacific Beat. We look at Fiji's political landscape. It's just got a tad more crowded ahead of its upcoming general elections. The newly registered One Nation Party has become the country's 10th political party, mostly made up of former Fiji First Party members. So what does another political party really mean for everyday Fijians? Helping us to unpack this more is Professor of Comparative Politics at the Victoria University in New Zealand, Dr. John Frankel. That I say, kia ora, Professor. Great to have you back on the show.
Kia ora, Yandra.
And thank you very much for joining us. I do want to ask, before we do actually just talk about this new party, are you aware of when Fijians are going to go to the polls? Is there an election date that has come through?
Well, I think Rambuk has made, the Prime Minister's made clear that it'll be sometime between December, and the latest it can be under the Constitution is February 2027. Hmm. So we're looking at an election over that period.
Yeah, I mean, right now there is a review on the Constitution happening, but do we know if Fiji will use that 2013 Constitution for the election?
I think it's highly unlikely. I've thought that highly unlikely right from the beginning, and I still think so. It's, there simply isn't enough time in order to put a new constitution in place, and also the processes that are being followed and are inadequate to the purpose of putting a new constitution in place. We've faced a very strange situation where the former largest party is being kind of liquidated. Parliament urgently needs a new, refreshed mandate in order to embark on a constitutional review, I think.
Mm. Okay, well, Professor, how significant is this entry, you know, of this new party, One Nation, into Fiji's political landscape?
Well, I think it is significant because the core question that everyone has been asking about the next election is what is going to happen to the vote that went to Fiji First at the last election. Fiji First was the party of Frank Bainimarama, the 2006 coup leader that had managed to win elections in 2014 and 2018. In 2014 with a big majority, but then lost in 2022. So it was capturing a lot of the support of the Fiji Indian share of the population and a significant ethnic Fijian vote share. So the question has been, where is that vote going to go? And there are lots of parties and individuals that are sort of seeking to get themselves elected on the basis of that vote, but this is one of them, this new sort of oddly named One Nation Party. I assume they didn't consider the Australian connotations of that before they adopted that name.
Yes, I was going to ask whether or not you thought there was any coincidence on the name and if there are any policies similar to the one here in Australia that Pauline Hanson runs.
I think it would be very difficult to mimic Pauline Hanson's policies in Fiji. It's a very different kind of place. I assume that that party is by using the name One Nation is probably trying simply to emphasise its nationalist orientation and its attempt to overcome ethnic cleavages within Fiji. And I don't think that will translate into any particular immigration policy, for example.
Well, Professor, as you were talking about, you know, the significance of this new party and the fact that it is, majority of this new party is made up of former Fiji First members. I'm just wondering then, how do you think this will strengthen their place as serious contenders for the upcoming elections?
Well, the presence of Bainimarama at that press launch as a figurehead is obviously very significant, but he himself cannot contest in the next election because he's been convicted of various crimes. Even though he didn't serve a full year, nevertheless, it's the conviction that counts. The other key figures here are, yes, as you mentioned, some Fiji First individuals, Ketan Lal and Fayaz Koya, for example. But a key player in this is also Tupou Dranidalo, who was not a Fiji First politician on the contrary. She used to be president of the National Federation Party and then stood for a new party called the Hope Party in 2018. And I think they got about 0.6% of the vote. So they didn't do very well back then. And we're still waiting. I mean, key figures in Fiji First have still not put their cards on the table. Some, like Ayaz Sayed Kem, are facing all sorts of court charges and will be lucky to remain out of jail. But there are others, like Pravin Bala, Premila Kumar, Alvin Maharaj, that haven't yet made clear where their political loyalties lie. And of course, the former Fiji First split. There's another faction in Fiji First that allied themselves with the government, and they're also contesting as part of a separate party.
Mm. Now, are you actually aware of any of One Nation's policies? Anything that you think would maybe make them stand out amongst the other parties?
Well, I think that they'll certainly claim to be kind of anti-ethnic cleavages and not sort of oriented towards the indigenous ethno-nationalist side of politics, as Bainimarama did when he was in office, and that's already conveyed in a sense in the name of the party. They have made claims about standing for good governance and opposing social inequality, but then I expect many of the parties will make that kind of position in their campaigns.
Mm. If you're just joining us here on Pacific Beat, I'm your host, Anita Bowie, and speaking with Professor Dr. John Frankel, trying to unpack this new political party, One Nation. What does that actually mean for everyday Fijians with the upcoming elections? Professor, what kind of challenges do you think, though, that they'll face, I suppose, coming up? Like, I ask that only because, will voter turnout maybe cost them as a new party, you know, because I understand previous years, you know, this has actually steadily declined.
Yes, and I would not be surprised at all if the next election were not a low turnout election, because it's the previous elections, there were sort of sharper divisions between the pro and anti-coup side, the pro-Bainimarama side, the anti-Bainimarama side, and you may find that that's not quite as acute this time around. From the point of view of the One Nation Party and these former Fiji First politicians who are trying to campaign, in the past, of course, they did so from a position of incumbency. Fiji First was able to win the election with a thumping majority back in 2014 because they were the government, and they managed to conveyed a message that if there wasn't a big Fiji First victory, there might well be another coup. That was also the message in 2018. It's quite a different thing trying to win an election from a position in the opposition. So I think they will struggle.
Mm. Well, with all elections, what should voters be looking for?
Well, this election is going to be an interesting one because it's the first one where voters will be pretty certain that Frank Bainimarama is not coming back as Prime Minister and that Fiji First is not going to be the government. I expect that a lot of people that might have thought twice about contesting during previous elections, this time around, this would be the election that you can expect to see a new generation of politicians coming forward. The constitution is a big issue. It's pretty clear that the constitution will not be changed ahead of this election, but it may well be changed afterwards. And therefore, that's voters will have to think about which political parties they want in office to deliberate about a new constitution. I think those are crucial issues, as is economic growth and the decline of the sugar industry. I was just looking at the data from the Reserve Bank quarterly bulletin, and it's astonishing that Fiji sugar exports are only one quarter of the level of bottled water exports over the last 5 years, so much as the Fiji sugar industry declined. So there is a restructuring and an major economic changes going on in Fiji, which the new government will have to manage.
Well, yeah, look, while I have you, and as we wrap up, Professor, how do you actually rate Sitiveni Rambuka's popularity? I mean, do you think his People's Alliance Party will come back as the lead party in government?
Well, I think they certainly are a strong incumbent political party. They don't face a lot of rivals for the indigenous vote. Sodelpa, which used to be the major indigenous party, split badly at the last election, and those splits haven't gone away, particularly since their leadership wanted to actually go with Fiji First, which was very unpopular amongst most of the rank and file. I think Rambuka's People's Alliance started off well with kind of moves to get rid of media censorship, restore grants to the University of the South Pacific, allow the ashes of Brij Lal to be returned to his birthplace on Vanua Levu, the Pacific historian. But they've rather lost their way on a few things, including MPs granting themselves pay rises in a very mishandled way, a lot of reshuffles that were badly handled, and above all, this commission of inquiry that was launched into the FICAC appointments, which was grossly mishandled. This curious Australian judge making this odd comment about being enlisted to hunt out the crocodiles in the pond suggests some degree of internal rivalry within the People's Alliance, which has to be overcome if they're going to move back into government after this next election.
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely something that we'll try and look into. But Professor, really appreciate you coming on the show this morning, just giving a little bit of insight into the current political landscape there in Fiji.
Vinaka.
That is Professor of Comparative Politics at the Victoria University of New Zealand, Dr. John Frankel, right here on Pacific Beat.
Talo Falava, I'm Sosefu Omoli. Join me every Tuesday afternoon for Sister Sounds, a music show dedicated to showcasing the breadth of talented female musicians and performers from across the Pacific. Sister Sounds will bring you amazing local talent mixed with the sounds and vibe our Islander audiences love by artists from across the seas as well. Tune into Sister Sounds Tuesday afternoon at 3 PNG time on NBC Radio Australia.
Join Jacob McQuire and Michael Chow for Nisha Daily every weekday morning on ABC Radio Australia.
The Dogon language, it's seeped into Nisha Daily. All right, Michael Chow, what is the phrase we always use here in the office?
Oi, oi, oi. It is. Sometimes when I listen to you guys, I'm like, oi.
Nisha Daily, weekday mornings from 7 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Malo te mau bong bongini. Thank you for joining us here on Pacific Beat. Now, look, if you're a regular or first timer to our show, binaka. Thank you for tuning in. I am your host, Aggie DeBol. Just going to give you a quick recap of what's been on the show so far. Now, we spoke about investigations into Timor-Leste over alleged scam centres. Also, there's a continuous debate over whether banning Gava is necessary after a massive haul worth $100,000s was seized in the Northern Territory of Australia. And there you would have just listened, we spoke about whether Fiji's newest political party will mean anything for everyday Fijians. Still to come, though, we're going to be looking into whether Papua New Guinea's rugby union has been abandoned by Oceania Rugby. What does that mean? Stay tuned for that. Before that story, let's head into your news wrap. Yes, it is that time where we head around the region to get the latest headlines. And there is quite a few this morning. And that's brought to you by our producer, Whenau Whanau, who's in the studio with me this morning. Fefe.
Sorry, Agi, I'm fine, thank you.
We've got a lot to get through. And this one where we start off with sport. I know a lot of rugby action happened over the weekend, especially for our Pacific nations. A little bit disappointing, but hey, we are still here for our Pacific teams. Firstly, the Flying Fijians, they suffered a huge loss to England. Tell us more.
Yes, 73 points to 8 loss to England. Ooh. In Liverpool. The Flying Fijians were dominated in both halves, England running a total of 11 tries. Wow. For Fiji, it's particularly disappointing because they were only recently given Tier 1 status. That's so right. not reflective of a Tier 1 nation, and in the wake of this demoralizing defeat, there's been criticism over the coaching, as usually happens after big defeats like this. The previous head coach, Mick Byrne, had been replaced earlier this year with Sini Seruvakula, and Prime Minister Sitiveni Rambuka was fronted by the media on this, and he's denied that he put pressure on the Fiji Rugby Union to dismiss the previous head coach, Mick Byrne. Speaking to the media in Suva, Mr. Rambuka said his preference has always been for a homegrown coach, but he insists he had nothing to do with Seruvakula's appointment.
Mm. I've always supported the concept of having a local coach who understands the nature, the psyche of the Fijian players. I was notified of the selection, and I said, well, let's see if the argument that a local coach would better understand and the players would better understand the coach. And two test matches is not enough to gauge whether that had been a successful process or not.
Prime Minister Sitiveni Rampoka no doubt hoping for better things from the Flying Fijians when they play Scotland in Edinburgh this weekend.
Okay, now we also hope for better things from Manu Samoa and Tonga's Ikaretahi. Can you give us the details on their matches?
Yeah, they didn't do well. Manu Samoa losing to Georgia by 33 points to 12.
Wow.
And to make it worse, Georgia were reduced to 14 men twice in the game.
Mm.
So Manu Samoa failed to take advantage of that player deficit. Three converted tries and penalties from Georgia gave them that big lead.
Mm.
As for the Galatahi, they lost by 32 points to 19, Spain dominating both halves on the scoreboard.
Hard luck for our Pacific teams, but as always, I know we're still very fully supportive of our island teams. Now, to Kiribati, I understand the country has celebrated its 47th year as an independent nation. Tell us a little bit more.
Yesterday, a police and student parade was held in Baisio, Tarawa, where a flag-raising ceremony was held. The country's Prime Minister, Taniti Maumau, addressed the nation with foreign delegates in attendance, and the theme for this year's Independence Day was Sustained Momentum for a Resilient Future. Kiribati gained independence from the United Kingdom on July 12, 1979, and since then the country has seen a rapid population growth. It was just over 60,000 in 1979. This year, it's over 138,000 people.
Wow, that is definitely a population growth. Well, well done, Kiribati. And we're wishing you a beautiful Independence Day in celebration. We head to Papua New Guinea now because I believe there were two elderly women that were rescued by law enforcement after a video of one of them being tortured went viral online. What happened here?
Yes, this was a sorcery violence-related case. The assaults and tortured video. The video was of one of the women being tortured at a basketball court in Porgera, and it was widely circulated on social media, prompting security forces to rescue two elderly women. Enga Provincial Police Commander Chief Superintendent Stephen Harris confirmed that two of the elderly women were seized and tortured at the basketball court after they were accused of practicing sorcery. He said one of the women were rescued, another had escaped her captors, and they haven't found her yet. Chief Superintendent Harris said the suspects have fled the scene and they haven't captured them, but investigations are continuing.
Yeah, and I know that's not the first instance of stories like this. So that's a story that we hope to cover and to keep our eyes and ears on and bring you more about that. Now, this is a very sad story. Sam Neill, famous Kiwi actor and documentarian, has actually passed at the age of 78. Now, he was known for a number of iconic movies. My favourite, of course, would be Jurassic Park. But some of his later work actually covered the Pacific Islands, right?
Yes, he was heavily involved in documentary making in the latest stages of his career. One of them was a six-part historical series, The Pacific in the Wake of Captain Cook. That was in 2018, and he traveled around the Pacific Islands.
Wow.
He visited all of the islands that Captain Cook visited, from Tonga to Hawaii. Yeah, it was an interesting documentary. If you haven't watched it, I recommend watching it.
Okay.
And he also did the 2016 movie Hunt for the Wilder People.
Yes.
Directed by Taika Waititi, and a lot of Maori themes in that movie.
That's a very classic Kiwi homegrown movie that definitely Sam Neill did so well in. And, well, look, we just say rest in peace and just know that that man did amazing work representing New Zealand and, of course, also Australia. Well, as always, Whenau, thank you very much for coming through and bringing us our stories here from across the region with your news wrap on Pacific Beat.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
All right, to sport now. The Papua New Guinea Rugby Union is still out in the cold, and they are starting to feel that they have been abandoned by the sport's ruling body in the Pacific. Oceania Rugby suspended PNG in September 2024 over a range of non-compliance issues. But now, nearly 2 years later, there is still no sign of the union being readmitted to the Pacific family. The acting president of the Papua New Guinea Union, Vincent Karua, believes that the organisation has done all they can to meet Oceania's demands, but he says no one at the organisation is even talking to them anymore, and he fears there may be other forces at play.
We have been working closely with the board to fix all the governance and administrative issues that led to the suspension. We have established a good relationship with the PNG Rugby community itself, setting up a new strategy plan for PNG Rugby and a new structural plan. That's what we have come up with.
So is there a timeline on this? Have Oceania Rugby indicated as to when they will readmit you into the family, as it were?
That's a good question. We have sent several emails and correspondence to where we are with the progress we've been making. But sad to say, we haven't been getting any formal response from Oceania Rugby, especially the president and the CEO.
To not get any feedback from Oceania Rugby, you must feel as though you've been abandoned.
100% correct. We tried to reach out, several emails, correspondence, tried to get a formal response directly and to see where the status of PNG Rugby is and to get also an update as to when we should be back on track. But unfortunate that we're not getting that.
In the meantime, what does rugby union look like in Papua New Guinea? Are the competitions that were taking place prior to the ban from Oceania still taking place?
It is still on. The big centres like Leh, Moresby, and other small provincial unions, they're still active. The question is when the ban would be lifted. And we're not getting any indication or even them reaching out to us to help us get back on track. That's a sad part of it.
And of course, the ban means that you are excluded and have been for 2 years now from all international competition, both within the Pacific and beyond.
Correct. Correct.
That must hurt.
Oh, pretty much, because, you know, the whole idea of trying to run a competition in PNG, you know, you want to have a pathway going for exposure and for international games. Unfortunately, we can't have that because we're still suspended.
There's a curious twist to all this, as I understand it. Following the collapse of Moana Pacifica in Super Rugby, I have been told that there was a declaration of intent submitted by the Papua New Guinea government through a third party suggesting that they might like to establish a Super Rugby franchise. Do you know anything about that?
No, I've not gotten any information on that. I think this is just new information that I'm getting now on behalf of the board, yeah.
I presume if you're not aware of it, this must be something the government think they can do on their own.
I believe so. I think there's a lot of strings attached. And the way we're going at the moment, I think Boston Rugby, though we're not corresponding straight with the CEO and the president, we're getting information that there's several email correspondence from other state entities, parties that are taking advantage of the suspension and trying to pave their way through the network.
This is something that we've seen happen in Papua New Guinea before, to rugby league, to soccer, for example, where you suddenly get rival organisations trying to run the same sport. Is that what you fear may be happening here?
I believe so, because there's a lot of people attached with state entities and organisations. They have their own networking stuff.
As an organisation, do you believe that this punishment that Oceania Rugby have meted out is fair and reasonable?
In a way, we take that on a positive approach. We need to be compliant, making sure that the administration is run correctly. We are doing that at the moment, and we've been giving updates to where the progress is. And I think that we have ticked off most of the boxes, and we're asking for a positive response to giving us a time frame. Unfortunately, we're not getting that.
Have you as an organisation contemplated going direct to World Rugby and saying to them, we can't get anything out of Oceania, what's going on, can you help us?
We have reached out to World Rugby, but World Rugby has put that back to Oceania Rugby to deal with it. And I pretty much think that we're still stuck. But it doesn't mean that we've given up hope, no. We have a strong hope that, you know, we're going to do what we have to do and sooner or later put it down to Oceania Rugby that this is where we are. And I think that we have complied and we think that the suspension should be lifted.
And that is Vincent Karua, acting president of the Papua New Guinea Rugby Union, talking to Richard Hewitt on the line from Port Moresby. Now, Pacific Beat has made several attempts to get some answers from Oceania Rugby about PNG's situation. But just like the union, we haven't had any response. When you look back at one of our main stories today, Timor-Leste police have raided several alleged scam centres in and around the capital, Dili. More than 90 foreign nationals have been arrested. Find those stories when you type Pacific Beach or Radio Australia into your search engine. Remember, we are across Facebook and Instagram also. Our team will be back same time tomorrow, 6 a.m. PNG time, but you can hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia, though, because your news is next. And coming up after that, it's Nisha Day. So until next time, o tua o whaatu. This is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.